Hello, I'm Jim Packard in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us this morning as we talk about the wonderful world of Wisconsin's wildlife with Scott Craven, UW-Madison Professor of Wildlife Ecology. And it's always a pleasure to have him back on the first Wednesday of the month. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Is there any good news in the world, of nature this morning?
Well, it seems to be hard to come by, Jim, but the good news is, hey, it's a great time of year. You know, animals are reproducing at this time. Populations achieve their annual highs and then begin to tail off throughout the summer and into next winter. Lots of songbirds around.
True.
The bird festival you mentioned in the introduction was a huge success last week. So when you see lots of people enjoying themselves and doing outside activities and birding and whatnot, there's some good things going on. But with the pall of the oil spill and assorted other world problems, it's sometimes a little tough to see the bright side.
We've talked about the effect on fish, but you bring up the turtles as well. They just got to be in a precarious position.
Well, it's affecting everything in that area that's alive, and some things that are not alive, like the beaches and all. And it's such a beautiful part of the country that to see it subjected to that kind of abuse essentially is really disheartening. And of course, sea turtles will be at risk. If there's any good news down there, at least compared to, say, some of the Alaskan spills and other issues, there are no huge marine mammal populations in that area. There are no very huge seabird colonies. And as far as the time of year when many of the North American waterfowl populations winter along the Gulf Coast, they're not there. They're up here now, so they're out of harm's way, at least temporarily. But on the other hand, that's an area of priceless and very fragile wetlands and estuaries that are the nursery for most of the Gulf. And we've all heard about the fisheries issues with crabs and shrimp and assorted finfish and whatnot. It's a terrible disaster. And for those of us that are, you know, hundreds or thousands of miles away, it's hard to imagine what we can do other than be sympathetic and hope for the best.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-642-1234 as we talk with Scott Craven. And we'll start off with Tom in South Beloit. Tom, what's on your mind today?
Good morning. It's a thrill to be on with you. I enjoy Phil every month. I wish he was on more often. But what my question was we've always had a lot of toads around the house, and this year seems like we have even more. But in addition to that, we've had tree frogs around, and this year at least a dozen of them have taken up residence underneath the railing of my above-ground pool.
Mm-hmm.
And at nighttime, some of them will jump in there, and you know, everybody's wondering, well, is that going to hurt them, you know, because there's chlorine in the pool and stuff like that. But it hasn't seemed to have affected them at this point. But I jumped at the chance to call in and ask you about that.
All right. Well, let's see what Scott has to say.
Well, in terms of seeing more or hearing more of these animals, it has been a good bounce back year for a lot of amphibians. We had a couple of tough winters 2 or 3 years ago. It was either dry or cold or deep snow, and then we had some dry ponds in the spring. And there was some concern that tree frogs, which I'm not that far from you, south of Madison, which were abundant 2 or 3 years ago, virtually disappeared for a couple of years, and now I'm starting to hear them again. And in my case, they take up residence under the grill cover on the gas grill. But the bottom line is, if they're around, everybody gets to hear them, see them, enjoy them. They eat insects and so on. That's all good. The fact that they're occupying the corners and covers of your pool and the edges is just good shelter for them. And if they get in the water, they're very dexterous in terms of climbing, which is one of the reasons we call them tree frogs. And they'll get out and go back to some shady spot. So I think it's just a matter of alerting everybody in the family or whoever's using the pool to watch out where you're grabbing or sitting and don't squish a frog, and everybody will be happy.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Tom. Thank you for the call. Got an email from Jim in Bayfield County who wants to thank you for being the keynote speaker at the 12th Annual Northwest Lakes Conference that will be held at Drummond High School on the 18th of June, shaping up to be another great event. The question that he has, what's happened to the turkeys? We had an abundance last year. We were tripping over them every time we walked through the woods. Is the harvest countdown across the state, or is this a local problem?
I'm inclined to, and thanks for the plug, by the way, the Lakes Conference that's coming up 2 weeks from Friday, I guess. Mm-hmm. I just got the schedule on that this morning. Had to be
BayfieldCountyLakes.org is the place to get the info.
You can get a schedule. There are lots of interesting speakers. It should be a good program for those interested in the ecology and use of lakes in the Northwoods. So that's coming up. As far as the turkeys are concerned, I mean, there are always going to be areas. Generally, the turkey population is still doing great, but there are always going to be areas where, there seem to be less turkeys, more turkeys in any given year. The harvest, I've not seen the harvest. The season just ended last week. There were some very difficult and challenging hunting periods because of weather within the six hunting periods, and it was a challenging spring overall because it started so darn early. Mm-hmm. The late hunts were like jungle conditions out there looking for turkeys. Now, I know some people who did very well and other people, including yours truly, who failed to subdue a turkey this year. So when the numbers come in, I wouldn't be terribly surprised to see them down a little bit, even though there is still plenty of turkeys. But there's no there's no problem or catastrophe out there looming on the horizon.
All right. Lots of sightings of cougars. The cougar keeps reappearing month after month.
Cougars keep reappearing. But I think that eventually the enthusiasm over cougars will settle down a little bit. It's quite clear to everyone now that there are cougars present in the state. How many is still up for grabs, whether they're reproducing is up for grabs. Their origin, I think, with states to the west of us is pretty well documented now. So all of that is kind of behind us, and the DNR and their cooperators, particularly a group of students and faculty at UW-Stevens Point, are diligently working on management strategies and ways to deal with these animals as they appear. For example, the most recent encounter just about a week and a half ago when a turkey hunter saw a cougar attacking a cow in Juneau County. The animal eventually, the cow had to be put down from the injuries. The cougar disappeared. That was on a Sunday, I think. On a Wednesday, not too far away, it killed a sheep on another farm. And the DNR has been pursuing that animal with the hopes of initially it was going to be captured and euthanized. And then there was some outcry about that, and then the plan was reversed to perhaps capturing it and donating it to a zoological park, whatever. I don't know what its fate would have been, but they haven't caught it, mm-hmm. and it may be a long shot to think they're going to catch it, so that's perhaps a moot point. But yes, cougar sightings continue to pop up in all corners of the state. While I was up at the birding festival, I had a gentleman relate seeing actually a couple of young with a large cougar. That has not been substantiated, but we're looking into that. So cougars continue to be on the forefront of many people's minds in the state.
All right, let's go to Jean in Menominee next. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I have to say I feel very bad for people in Louisiana. I live outside of Menominee, and I live by the waterfall production area.
Mm-hmm.
And I have tons of birds.
Mm-hmm.
And a bear came through and had his share this first spring. And then I pulled in everything for two and a half weeks. And then it hit me again. And then 2 weeks later, I did it again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's a small baby bear. We're not seeing any footprints. But I have some very heavy-duty hangers. They're solid steel for hanging my food.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're solid steel, and they're just bent right in half.
Well, then it's obviously not a squirrel or a raccoon or something smaller than that. So
the funny thing is we only have a red squirrel out there.
Mm-hmm. So what are you looking for additional strategies to try and circumvent the bear attacks, or is this something you feel you have to...
bear or some really fat coon or, you know, because I don't see any bear feet.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, is there anything I can put out or...
You know, bird feeding in bear country or even in raccoon country, which is more what I'm faced with, is a constant challenge. And attempting to suspend the feeders, certainly so they're high enough off the ground so the bears can't reach them from the ground, and figure out some way to suspend them on a strong enough but thin enough cable so that the bear either can't find the cable or can't shinny over it. And if you use a heavy cable, there were some fantastic pictures circulating on the internet a year or so ago of a bear kind of handlining itself like it was on a zip line in the tropics down this cable, a very acrobatic move to get at a feeder. So they'll go to great lengths to get the feeder and what's in it. And about all you can do is stay one step ahead of them in terms of the creativity with which you suspend these feeders or somehow get them up so the bear can't get at them. Whether you put them on get a pulley high up in a tree so that you can lower the feeder down when you need to fill it and then raise it up out of reach and, you know, run the pulley up to a, you know, second floor window or something like that, or be as creative as you can. But if it gets to the point where you just can't get past it, then at the time the bears, times of the year when the bears are very active, suspend your bird feeding operations. You won't have much choice.
And put a trail camera in instead.
Yeah, and if you're not, the fact that you're not seeing tracks or sign doesn't mean that it's not a bear or that the bear isn't there. And as Jim points out, use of these motion-sensitive trail cameras has become very popular, and even people who are not using them for hunting purposes use them for wildlife detective purposes, and you'll be able to see exactly what's going on. And perhaps by securing a series of trail camera pictures, you'll get some insight into how the bear approaches or what it's doing that might help you design some sort of a suspension system that will defeat it.
Good luck to you, Gene. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Nathaniel in Mequon next. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi there. kind of stole my thunder on the cougar issue.
I tried to get out in front of that, to be honest with you.
So you probably don't have much more to add. Just recently, though, friends have been talking about hearing on the news a DNR official of some sort saying that there was a possibility that there were cougar, like, in southeast Wisconsin. So they were theorizing maybe, like, the only places would be the Milwaukee River Corridor or maybe the Kettle Moraine. And I'm just wondering about the possibility of that. But it sounds to me like you've already said that a couple of cougar here and there is probably possible.
Well, there are a couple of issues. Now, if cougars are going to get into the state and settle in for the long haul, they'll certainly be better off in parts of northern and west central Wisconsin than they would be in the southeast. However, remember that the first actual documentation, the one that received the most sightings, the records, and ultimately the DNR sample, was the cougar that started out just east of Janesville and meandered around and ended up meeting its fate at the hands of police officers in Chicago. So there's a couple of issues here. One are cougars that are transients, and they can cover a lot of ground that could be seen in any county in the state, no matter where, and those that may be settling in and trying to make a living, and they would be more likely to gravitate to less densely settled, less populated, less human activity kinds of places, which you'd expect more in the north and west central part of the state.
So, Nathaniel, thanks very much, but cougars are everywhere these days.
I see one right now.
Get a good picture and send it in.
Get a picture, send it to us. Nathaniel, thanks for the call, and if you'd like to join the conversation, the number for you is 1-800-642-1234. We're talking with Scott Craven, UW-Madison and Extension Wildlife Ecology Professor, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rachel Owens is our on-air producer today. And, of course, our guest is Scott Craven as we talk about the wonderful world of Wisconsin's wildlife. In addition to the cougar sightings in the state, we're now seeing or hearing about more bear sightings in the southern part of the state.
Yes. In fact, the bear that generated a lot of interest in the Wanakee area a week or so ago seemed to have disappeared, and we thought, gee, maybe the bear thought better of a foray into the south and had retreated. Not so. It was back again last night, and I got a series of probably 15 photographs by email this morning. So the bear's back in Wanakee, and there were sightings of another bear in Waseca a day or so ago. They're, you know, I don't want to say they're all over the place, but bear sightings have become much more commonplace than they were. Mm-hmm. Of course, the bear population is doing very, very well. The bear harvest record last fall was an all-time record with just over 4,000 bears taken. Hunting opportunity has been greatly liberalized to try and get the upper hand on the bear population. But while all this is going on, it's quite likely that we'll see more and more young bears foraying into the South. And people should get used to seeing them and understand what their reaction should be. And that's not to rush up to them and try and hand them a donut or take a close-up picture or put their arm around them for photograph. Give them a wide berth. They're not really here looking for human companionship, and it's best to respect them for the large, powerful, wild animal they are. Take a picture, watch them from a distance, report them, but leave them alone.
Let's go to Dick in Wausau next. Hi, Dick. Go ahead.
Hello. 2 weeks ago, while I was turkey hunting in Florence County, I saw a yellow squirrel.
Mm-hmm.
It had the same size and other physical characteristics of a gray squirrel.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a brilliant yellow with a tinge of orange in its color.
Mm-hmm.
Is that another variant of the gray squirrel?
Well, there are a couple of possibilities. Gray squirrels have several color phases. Of course, the further north you go in Wisconsin, the black squirrels become fairly common and very popular. But there's another color phase that seems to be a little more common further south, but not as common as the black, and that's a yellow or golden yellow color phase that's often called a Lady Isabella squirrel. It's still a perfectly normal gray squirrel. This is just a variation in hair coloration, just like my hair is sort of still brown and Jim's hair is sort of still whatever color it is. I can't see across the room here. So
that's a good thing.
There's variation that can occur in the same litter. So the likely possibility is that Lady Isabella squirrel, on the other hand, a fox squirrel, which is the same size or a little bigger than a gray squirrel, different species, but their extremities, belly, and so forth are a brilliant orange and can range on the one side toward a lighter yellow and on the other side toward almost black. So I'm not altogether sure which one you saw. I would lean toward the yellowish or golden color variant of a gray squirrel, but it could have been a little unusual fox squirrel as well.
I'm familiar with the fox squirrel,
okay.
And I'm positive it was not a fox squirrel.
Okay. And in some cases where there are, for example, at the university's field station up on Lake Tomahawk, we see all sorts of variants in between. There are quite a few black squirrels there, but I've seen them that are kind of an auburn colored, almost mahogany, some that are grayish but have a brown tail, and all sorts of combinations and permutations. So depending on where you are, you could see just about anything, but they are perfectly normal gray squirrels in every other way other than hair color.
Okay, thank you.
All right, mm-hmm. Dick, thanks very much for the call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 as we talk with Scott Craven. Got an email from Jim and Irma. We're paddling up by the Michigan border Saturday of Mother's Day weekend. Watched an eagle swim quite a distance to shore. It looked like a giant bat doing the breaststroke. Crawled up on shore and began swinging its wings to dry them and looked like it would take quite a while to dry off. It's very windy that day. We wondered if it could have blown in while it was making a catch or perhaps it caught a fish too big to lift.
Well, it could have been a variety of things. Sometimes when they're squabbling with each other or diving on a loon chick or attempting to grab a fish, miscalculation, downdraft, whatever, ploop, they're in the water. And at that point, once they're wet, it's very difficult for them to take off. So they do essentially the breaststroke and beat those large wings and get into shore and then dry off and away they go. So it's correctable on the eagle's part.
Kurt in Chippewa Falls, let's give you a chance to get in. Go ahead.
Thank you. Comment before my question about the bear thing. When we were farming in southern Taylor County some years ago, 20, 25 years ago, we were starting to see black bear up and down our roads and in and out of the woods. So it's been coming on for some time. I'm not surprised.
Mm-hmm.
My question has to do with, in our backyard, we have a bird waterer, shallow, and a pair of crows seems to have taken it over. And when they leave and they make a mess of it, I go out and I find the shells of pine cones, and we are surrounded by a pine plantation. And the other day also a stub of a leftover corn cob from last fall.
Mm-hmm.
My theory is they drop it in there to soak it, make it softer, and then tear them apart and eat them. What do you think?
Perhaps, but I've also had reports over the years of crows stashing all manner of slightly more disgusting food items like dead chipmunks and bird nestlings and assorted other things, leaving those in a bird bath, or at least parts thereof. So whether their intention is to return for them or not, that remains a bit of a mystery, but it's not uncommon for them to leave food items in a bird bath.
Okay.
In the case of the the hard things, you know, birds learn a lot of things, and crows are very capable when it comes to both wariness and intelligence, if you want to attach that term to birds. And there may be something to your theory that if they've got something that's too hard for them to work on, and they think that may or have learned from experience that will soften it up, then that's also a plausible explanation.
It looks to me like from a distance. They have something between their toes, and they're pecking and pulling at it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I get my supposition from. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. Let's talk a little bit about the warnings that have come in from the DNR about what to do with baby birds, fawns that you might see, that kind of thing.
Well, it's that time of year, and we usually talk about it every year, whether it's, hey, the turtles are now out looking for nesting sites, so watch out for those on the road. Help them out of the road if you can without risking your own safety or snarling up traffic. People are also going to come across nestling birds that have fallen out of the nest or that have just fledged and look like they're in trouble but probably aren't, and all manner of other baby mammals up to and including the fawns that you just mentioned. And we started getting reports of fawn drop a couple weeks ago. It usually peaks around June 1st, right about now, but of course it has been a very early spring for some things that wouldn't have affected the fawns that were conceived way back last fall, but for other things that started, boy, there were goslings from the goose families around a month and a half ago. So, yes, there are lots of things out there. And the rule of thumb, once again, is that 95 times out of 100, maybe more, these animals that look like they're orphaned or in distress or abandoned or whatever are not. And the parent mammal or bird, excuse me, is somewhere in the area and may only visit them at times of security, darkness, or what have you to take care of them, but they're okay. And the real problems start when we intervene and think that, oh, I better do something here, and snatch the baby bird away, and now all of a sudden it's now separated from the parents. What are you going to do with it? They're difficult to take care of. The rehabilitators, the nature centers, the animal care centers are overwhelmed with orphaned animals this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a very difficult situation. So by far, the rule of thumb is leave them alone. Chances are they're going to be fine. And if they're not, realistically, I mean, most of these animals reproduce at a much higher rate than we could possibly sustain. Every baby robin that's produced, every fawn that's dropped can't survive, or the populations would be put at risk, and many of our interests would be put at risk as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it may seem a little harsh, but some of these animals, survival of juvenile animals is low. That's just the way it is. There are some circumstances, however. And over the years, I don't know how many broods of ducklings I've been called to rescue from one thing or another, but if it is a clear case where a brood of ducklings or anything else is clearly in immediate danger, trapped on the island of a busy road, up against a curb they can't hop over, about to drop down a storm drain, they were hatched on a roof that has a ledge around it that they can't get off of. In those kinds of cases, then intervention is necessary, and it's a good thing to do. It's a feel-good thing as far as human interactions with wildlife. In the case of the ducklings or goslings or what have you, they can usually be rounded up in a corner or something, scooped up and put in a box. But the key thing there is you have to catch the hen first. Catch the hen, corner her, use a fishing net or whatever, corner her, have someone hold her, then scoop up the ducklings or goslings, take them to the nearest pond or lake, let them go in the reverse order. Dump out the ducklings, they'll all gather in a little peeping ball and swim away. Then when you let the hen go, she'll go to the ducklings. If you let her go first, there's a chance she may take off, and then the whole thing kind of blows up in your face.
Yeah.
But there are some cases where intervention is necessary. I mean, the parent animal is there dead in the road. The young are huddled up on the side of the road. Yes, in that case, try and get them to a rehabilitator or a nature center, or do what you can to get them to a safe place. But in most cases, leave them alone.
Well, the DNR has a campaign going on to educate Wisconsinites about allowing wild animals to remain in their natural habitat. Got a lot of criticism for that from some quarters in the state.
Well, there's been a bit of a firestorm of backlash to that because of the partnership with the Humane Society of the United States, which provided some funding for this campaign. I think the rationale was that, boy, money's hard to come by, and anyone who's willing to contribute or help out towards something of mutual interest, okay, no harm done. But there were many folks, based on what I see in some of the outdoor magazines, newspapers, and so forth, who felt that for the DNR to partner with an organization that in some cases or their leadership has stated that their position is generally opposed to, say, recreational or sport hunting or trapping or some other elements of wildlife use, that agitated some sections of Wisconsin society. But the bottom line is the message is still good,
right,
and still valid. Leave those baby animals alone. Leave them in the wild where they belong.
Casey's wondering about cougar sightings, of all things. Hello, Casey.
Hello. Yes, Mike, I'm up here in Marinette County, a little further north. I guess my question to you is, what kind of dangers are we kind of looking at with this kind of not being native to this environment? I guess I got a six-year-old, and I'm just kind of wondering if I let him go outside and play.
Well, first of all, Casey, I mean, cougars were native to Wisconsin. They were here. They were native species. They were extirpated or essentially driven out of the state or killed off, driven out, whatever you want to call it. So their return to the state is a fairly natural restoration of the status quo. Given human land use and the heavy human footprint in Wisconsin, I don't think it's very likely that we'll see anything approximating an abundant cougar population for many, many years, if ever. So these are going to be scattered individuals, perhaps transient individuals, here today, gone tomorrow kind of thing, and so scarce in distribution that the odds of anyone running into one at any given time or of a child in the backyard, you know, being at some risk is unbelievably small, but not zero. So neither I nor anyone else can tell you that there's absolutely no risk at sending your child out to play in the yard. But the risk to your child or anyone's child in the backyard from strangers, meteorites, lightning, a fall, or choking on a stick, or a myriad of other things are far greater and far more realistic than the risk from a cougar or wolf or some of the other large carnivores that now inhabit Wisconsin.
Casey, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you as we talk with Scott Craven about the wonderful world of Wisconsin's wildlife. Ann is next in Madison. Hello, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi. We live out in the town of Springdale, kind of by Riley. And a couple weeks ago, my husband came across a nest on the ground, which I think we assume was turkey nest. And there were maybe like 10 or 11 eggs at first, like on Friday when he saw it, and then a couple days later there were a couple more eggs. And so he watched it for a couple of days, and the hen was kind of in the vicinity in the tall grass back there. And then all of a sudden, after a few days, the eggs were gone. It didn't look like they had hatched. There were no, remainders of eggs. Where do they go? Would the hen have moved them, or do predators take them all? I mean, what becomes? And this has happened before, like to a friend of mine had the same experience a few years ago.
Well, as we were just talking about with the baby animals, all stages leading up to the baby stage, in other words, eggs and so forth, are all vulnerable to a whole host of animals that consume each other. That's the way the system works. And turkey nests, which are on the ground, large. The eggs are large. There's usually about a dozen. That's a big heap of protein for a passing possum, raccoon, fox, skunk, coyote, or what have you. So there are a number of things that would remove them. The hen could not move them at all. They don't have the physical capability of doing so. So if a nest was there and the eggs disappear, if it hatched, the eggshells would be present. In some cases, depending on the predator, crushed eggshells might be there and there'd be egg remains scattered around. It could be a bit messy. If they're picked up and moved, then animals like coyotes and foxes and so forth will just make one trip after another to the nest, pick up an egg, go cache it somewhere where they can obtain it later and until they're gone. And there's no sign of anything. The nest may still be there or you know where it was, but there's no sign of any eggs. The good news is that most birds are adapted to this kind of predation, and they will re-nest a little later on when they've accumulated enough energy to do so. So it's part of the scheme of things that keeps us from being up to our ears in turkeys or any of the other species that are reproducing right now.
And thank you so much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. Email question from Mark. Lots of pelicans on Lake Winnebago, but I've never seen any babies. Where do the pelicans nest?
Well, there are a couple of nesting colonies around the state. They can fly a long way to feed, so they may fly a long way from a colony to feed, but the most conspicuous colony is in Lower Green Bay, just outside of the city of Green Bay, on a couple of islands just up from the big bridge there that I think is Highway 43, I think. So anybody with a spotting scope there on the beaches or whatnot could see lots of pelicans coming and going, and that's one of the largest nesting colonies, but I think there are a few others as well. So several people have reported pelicans to my office not knowing what they are. Hey, what are these huge white birds that are flying around? They are white pelicans, and they seem to be increasing in number in Wisconsin, and on our big lakes, people will start to see more of them.
All right. Let's go to Drew in Palmyra next. Hello, Drew. What's on your mind?
Wondering about the male-female ratio of raccoons in Kettle Moraine of southeast Wisconsin. Seems to be about 80% male. Wondering if this is an indicator of disease or just the natural way of things for raccoons. Thanks.
No clue. I guess, Drew, if you're still on there, how do you know what the sex ratio is? Are you a trapper?
I think he departed.
Well, I guess I'm not sure how that information would come to be known to most people, unless he is a trapper and that's been the sampling. And in some cases, perhaps the actual trapping technique may be differentially selecting one sex over another. So I really can't answer that. Sex ratios are generally pretty close to even in most species, and if there's some sort of a skewing differential mortality for whatever reason, I simply don't know on that one, Jim.
There have been sightings of armadillo in nearby Columbia County. What's going on there?
Well, there was a report about two and a half weeks ago that a woman driving to work in Columbia County had spotted I'm not sure whether she knew what it was. Maybe she did, maybe not, but reported this strange animal dead on the side of the road, took a picture of it, sent it in, and it certainly was an armadillo. By the time the various interested parties were able to return to the site, which she described very thoroughly, armadillo was gone. Don't know what happened to it, whether it was picked up by a scavenger, passerby, or what have you. But I think that was the third such record of an armadillo on a Wisconsin roadside over the last couple years. Now, the concern, of course, is that, oh my gosh, armadillos are moving north from the Gulf Coast just like possums did a century ago. And there is some, armadillos have been making a steady northward movement over the years, and apparently there are quite a few records of armadillos now in southern and even into central Illinois. No one seems to think that they can survive our current Wisconsin winters. So whether these two or three armadillos were actually the advanced party thinking about scouting out Wisconsin, I think it's far more likely that these were animals that were either a prank, someone coming up from the south, ha-ha, let's chuck a dead armadillo out on the road and see what kind of attention this gets, or B, armadillos that, like any other animal, often get picked up on trucks or whatever that are going all over the countryside. They're either on a load of produce or hay or what have you, and boom, all of a sudden, they end up in a strange place. either of those are more likely explanations than armadillos moving naturally into Wisconsin, but that, of course, is one of a whole host of concerns as we see global climate change kicking in over our area and everywhere else in the continent.
Kate in Sussex is next. Hello, Kate. What can we do for you today?
Oh, good morning. I'm sorry. There's a train passing.
We can hear it.
If you give me just a second.
You must live very close to the tracks.
I have a problem with rabbits that have been nesting in my backyard. Mm-hmm. And I heard what you were saying earlier about leaving baby animals alone. And we do want to leave them alone because we have no interest in trying to move them. But I was wondering if there was something that we could do to make our yard less attractive to the rabbits.
Well, if there is, I don't know what it is, because rabbits are pretty much generalist when it comes to backyard habitat. And, unlike you, I currently am involved in open warfare with the rabbit population in my backyard because of my interest in gardening. Rabbits and early season vegetable gardens are not the greatest mix. So I suspect around the state, many people are gnashing their teeth about abundant rabbits, ground squirrels, and assorted other things that are making gardening a bit of a challenge right now. So whether they're young rabbits, old rabbits, or anywhere in between, I'm doing all I can to remove them right now from the area of the garden, and I suspect others are as well. In terms of minimizing habitat, if you have an open deck, you should skirt it. If you've got wood piles or things like that that are around the corners of yards, get them up on racks off the ground. Minimize any corners that you've kind of let go, and maybe they have some dense brush that you just gave up on weeding. Anything you can do to more tightly clean up and manicure the yard and eliminate food sources will help. But I can't imagine anything short of a big box store parking lot that you'd be able to attribute as zero rabbit habitat.
Well, typically, how long does it take the rabbit young to leave the nest? You would like to fill in the hole when they're gone, but we don't want to disturb them until they are.
Well, they won't be in the, if you found the form, are their eyes open yet?
Their eyes, they just were born about 4 or 5 days ago.
Well, I think you may still have a week or 10 days. The doe rabbit usually visits that nest at night when it's quiet and nurses the young then, and all of a sudden they'll just disappear when they get up to maybe 4 inches long and their eyes are open. So you can kind of monitor their growth a little bit, but you shouldn't have too long to wait before they're out on their own. On the other hand, a female rabbit that starts breeding in, say, March around here, especially in early spring, will have 5 or 6 litters by September. So she's going to cycle very quickly from the ones you're currently watching to another litter not too far away. And if you've got other females and they stagger the litters, you are looking at an almost constant supply of baby rabbits.
What joy. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Kate, for the call. Good luck to you in Sussex. She may have to go for a Wasilla-type fence in order to keep everyone out. We're talking about the wonderful world of Wisconsin's wildlife with Scott Craven, UW-Madison and Extension Wildlife Ecologist, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's our regular meeting with Scott Craven, UW-Madison and Extension Wildlife Ecologist, the first Wednesday of each month, as we talk about the wonderful world of Wisconsin's wildlife. Each month, there have been a deeper drought in northern Wisconsin. Some of those lakes are down 12, 14 feet.
Well, it's pretty amazing. We have a cabin up in northeastern Price County, and our lake's down a couple feet, which is manageable. But holy cow, you see some that look like canyons with a trickle of water through them and bogs that are just a puddle in the middle of the former basin. So, yes, it's a dramatic and long-term drought. When and if it will break, is anybody's guess. I certainly, we all hope it breaks soon because it's having some tremendous impacts on, it's hard on reptile and amphibian populations. while there may be some short-term benefits to wildlife in terms of increased shoreline vegetation, as that shoreline becomes a much broader area, I think ultimately that's that the water's receded from much of the cover, the down trees and brush and whatnot that were cover for young fish, for frogs, for assorted other things, and has concentrated the remaining life of that lake in those central basins, which makes things very difficult. It's also spawning some concern, no pun intended, over the impacts of largemouth bass, which seem to be thriving in these conditions and perhaps displacing walleyes in some lakes, where walleyes are, of course, the preferred fish for many fishermen, and some interesting ecological relationships like that. But the bottom line is it is darn dry. Trees and forest vegetation seem to be showing some stress, and the lakes are literally disappearing. So we could use some rain up there.
We had a call from Bob in the Gordon area who said that his area has been overrun with snapping turtles. Have other areas seen this as well?
I have not had any reports of unusual number of snapping turtles, but this is the time of year that the snapping turtles head out from bodies of water looking for a nest site, and they're very conspicuous. And I can see when you after you've seen three or four or five 5, 10, 15, 20-pound turtles saying, oh, my gosh, it's a plague of giant turtles. So it would get someone's attention, but there's no evidence that it's anything out of the ordinary. But as people see these big snapping turtles out on land, I'm going to offer a bit of a corollary to the earlier advice about helping a turtle across the road. If it happens to be a 20-pound snapping turtle, be careful, because they're surprisingly quick on land. They will continue to spin around to face the helping hand that's trying to get them across the road. And if you're not careful, they can move that neck and that long neck and head very quickly. And if they get a hold of you, it's not a good thing. So you give most of the little turtles, you pick them up by the shell and move them without fear of damage. Mm-hmm. But a snapping turtle has a very nasty disposition when on dry land. So be careful.
Harry in Milwaukee, let's go to you next. Hi.
Good morning, Scott. Just had a question for you. We're from Milwaukee, but we've got a camp up on Big Beta Knock in Stonington Peninsula. And a couple of days ago, we were in the water, and we grabbed a lizard-like, I'd say it was about a young one, probably 3 or 4 inches long, and did some research, and it came out, it looked in the book to be like what's called a hellbender.
Probably there are a couple of aquatic salamanders like that, and it far more likely that it was a mud puppy.
Well, it had a flat, more snake-like triangular head with no gills. It had an eel-like tail, short legs. It really did match up to the information on hellbenders, and it had a little orange streak on its cheek. And like I say, it was completely different head than a newt or a salamander. It was like a snake head.
And no external gills?
No external gills.
Hmm. Well, in a mud puppy, the external gills should be pretty obvious, feather-like red structures. And same thing on any larval salamander. I mean, if even a larval form of a tiger salamander or spotted salamander could be 4 or 5 inches long, from an early egg laying, but still the external gills should be obvious. So, but boy, hellbenders are not generally credited, although they move up the Mississippi River, not really even getting into Wisconsin waters. So they don't.
We've been there 18 years, and we've never seen one before. And like I say, too, it also has a flat head. Where all the other species seem to have more of a rounded head.
Well, I mean, the mud puppy has a pretty big head and a gigantic mouth, too, but do you have any pictures of it, or what'd you do with it?
We released it.
Okay. Well, no, that's understandable. I mean, that's what most people would have done. Did you by any chance get any pictures?
No. But I think our next trip we'll probably try to recapture one and take a picture.
Well, if you catch it or one of its siblings or whatever, then for sure send in a picture or get back in touch with us, because that would be really a long ways from I think what's considered the normal range for a hellbender.
Yeah, I just, like I say, we've never seen one before, and we're in the water a lot, and so it was kind of interesting.
Harry, thanks for the call.
Okay,
we appreciate
thanks a lot.
Hearing from you. And the number for you to get in on this conversation is 1-800-642-1234 as we talk with Scott Craven. Let's go to Hannah in Kakana next. Hello, Hannah.
Hi.
Hi.
Glad I got through. I just have a question that's more of a curiosity. I'm in my mid-50s, and I remember growing up in the Fox River Valley, and we would see pheasants very commonly.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a pheasant in spring, and this is the first pheasant I've seen in about 15 years. And it seems to me that once the turkeys were introduced, I saw no more pheasants. Is it just a change in habitat, or with all the prairie restoration, you would think there'd be pheasants in many places?
Well, actually, up until 2 or 3 years ago, pheasants were doing remarkably well. The wild pheasant population was doing well. There were people 20 years ago that were willing to write pheasants off from agricultural Wisconsin, that they were on their way out and were present in very low numbers. And then along came the Conservation Reserve Program, which set aside a lot of agricultural land into permanent grass cover. And at the same time, as you pointed out, were a lot of people interested in prairie restoration and whatnot. And those habitat changes, the pheasants really responded well. And as I said, up until the winters of 2 or 3 years ago, the first one of which had lots of ice, and then we had that 110 inches of snow or whatever in the Madison area, and it just literally knocked them down to nearly nothing. I did the same thing. I restored or planted 12 acres of prairie on our property just south of Madison, and it was really like the Field of Dreams. I was interested in pheasants, so I built that habitat, so to speak, and all of a sudden, holy mackerel, it was unusual to not have 3 or 4 pheasants run through the backyard every night for 3 or 4 years. And then those 2 winters, I've not seen or heard a crowing rooster pheasant on my property now for 2 years. Not one, not a single one. Nor have I seen what I thought was a wild bird run across the road or fly across the road in the last 2 years. So your observations are correct over recent years, but around Horican Marsh, for example, in the glacial habitat restoration area, which is not too far from you, south a little bit, as I said, wild pheasants were doing very well, and there are still some there, but not nearly as many as we had just a few years ago. Hopefully, with some early springs like we had here and a couple more benevolent winters, they'll bounce back, but we'll see.
Oh, that's interesting to know. About 5 years ago, I was living in a more urban area, so mm-hmm. I wouldn't have seen them.
Well,
but I just kind of missed them and wondered.
Well, they're a beautiful bird. You know, some people are still edgy because they're not a native species, but they've been around for a long time. And, of course, the population is still augmented by heavy stockings from birds raised at the Poinette State Game Farm that are generally stocked on public hunting grounds around the state to provide hunting opportunities. So there'll be an influx of birds at least come the hunting season.
Hannah, thanks for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Tammy in Glidden next. Hello, Tammy.
Well, hello. I've got an experience about the snapping turtles.
Uh-huh.
Okay, when I was younger, we were camping down in Pewaukee, and we found about a 15, 20-pound snapping turtle out on the cement. And someone in the front took a 2-inch stick to get it in front of the mouth,
mm-hmm.
but don't even try to go near the tail. They jump backwards, and they hit you with the tail. But we did finally capture it and put it in a lake. Tell people, just leave them alone. They jump so fast. We couldn't believe a turtle can jump backwards.
Yeah, they actually kind of push themselves up and raise their hind end and lower their front end to protect their head. And, yes, that was the point I was trying to make, that they look big and awkward and ungainly and slow, but they can spin around and move and raise themselves up and snap with that long neck surprisingly quickly. Be
and
careful.
Hit you with the tail.
Yes.
Tail hurts just as much, too. Leave them alone.
Tammy, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Free fishing weekend this weekend in the state of Wisconsin.
Yes, a great opportunity for this weekend, June 5th and 6th. Anybody, any age, whatever. Of course, kids can fish without a license anyway, but anybody else who's mm-hmm. been thinking about giving it a try or just wanted to go and not buy a license for a couple of days, go fish to your heart's content all weekend. All other regulations, however, other than the requirement for a license still apply. So bag limits or species that you can or can't fish for it at a given time of year, size limits, those kinds of things all still apply, but no license required. And you can team it up on June 6th, which I think is Sunday. That's also State Park Open House Day. So you can go to a state park. You don't need an admission sticker. You can fish for free. It's unbelievable, really.
It is. Life is great.
it's a great deal.
And I think that there's some free fishing clinics also.
Yes, if you go onto the general DNR website and click on Free Fishing Day, you'll find out that at a number of state parks and also in different communities where the local sports clubs are offering clinics to teach kids how to fish. There's one, for example, at Lake Delton on Saturday morning, celebrating 2 years now since Lake Delton's been refilled and restocked and all. So there's a kids' fishing clinic there. And at other places around the state where not only can you learn about it, but they'll have loaner equipment and prizes and things like that. And there's also loaner equipment at many of the state parks that will be open where you can go and say, gee, I'd like to try fishing. And boom, here's a rod and reel. Go give it a try.
And muskie season opens in the northern part of the state tomorrow. Saturday, I should say.
Yeah, I think so. Soon, in any event. The bass season is still catch and release until for another few days, but muskie season will be open, and there's all sorts of things going on.
All right. We'll take more of your calls and your emails as we continue to talk with Professor Scott Craven. He is a UW-Madison and Extension wildlife ecologist, and you can get a hold of him at srcraven@wisc.edu. Send your pictures of wildlife sightings, and he'll comment about them. We're talking the wonderful world of Wisconsin's wildlife on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Jim Packard in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks very much for listening. Today we're talking with Scott Craven, UW-Madison and Extension wildlife ecologist, about the wonderful world of Wisconsin's wildlife. And we've had lots of questions and topics that we've dealt with in the first hour, and we'll do the same here in the last half hour. Had an email from Carson in Lake Geneva saying, I understand there's going to be a control kill of Canadian geese somewhere in southeastern Wisconsin. Where exactly is this happening, and are other areas considering it as well? And he hopes so. That's kind of unusual.
Well, the reality, Jim, is that the most high-profile recent plan was, of course, to kill some geese at Warner Park that were associated with Dane County Regional Airport and therefore considered a threat to aircraft safety. And I admit to being somewhat baffled. The city council voted very quickly and decisively several months ago, okay, these geese are a problem. It's documented. We accept that. We're going to remove some of them, and lethally. I thought, boy, that seems odd that would go through so smoothly. And, of course, as time went by, support for the geese managed to materialize from a variety of places, and they've now retrenched on that in favor of other tactics, which may or may not alleviate the situation, but will certainly be slower. So in that case, I certainly hope nothing dreadful happens because, well, anyway, the upshot of the call, however, is that geese are controlled with roundups and euthanasia, killing if you prefer that term, all over the countryside on a regular basis. That particular program was started in Minnesota decades ago, where surplus birds, of course, another term some people might take issue with. But nevertheless, birds were rounded up, removed to processing plants and processed like domestic poultry. And the meat came back from those and was used to stock food pantries and homeless shelters where the protein was more than welcome. And that seemed like a pretty straightforward program and generally received a fair bit of support. And those kinds of roundups have been conducted in the eastern and southeastern counties in Wisconsin for some time and are conducted in many other places. So why a few geese in a given location seems to stir up such strong sentiment is a little difficult to understand because this is a situation with a bird that admittedly very charismatic, popular, and has a number of features. I worked with them for 8 years.
Yeah.
All my graduate degrees, I've handled and banded close to 10,000 of them. I love geese, but I also understand that it's quite possible to have too much of a good thing in many settings where these resident or urban goose populations have just burgeoned over the last 10 or 15 years. At one point in the 90s and early part of the century, I think the growth rate for giant Canada geese, which is this race, was about a neighborhood of 13, 14, 15% a year. And if the problem in a given city park or golf course or whatever is too many geese, it seems obvious to me that the solution is less geese. And then the debate, of course, centers in on how are you going to go from X high number to Y low number. And that's where the problem results. But certainly eliminating some of these birds is favored by many people and opposed by some others. And it will remain controversial. But many of the other techniques are slow acting, and if a rapid fix is necessary or desirable, oiling eggs and doing things like that for a long-lived bird may reduce recruitment, but it doesn't do anything to remove those adult birds that are very faithful to a given area.
Let's go to Marty next in Osseo. And Marty, what's on your mind today?
I just wanted to thank you, gentlemen, for your perspective, especially the just the cycle of life and how, you know, wildlife does have its own system of elimination of growth. And I get so frustrated with some of the organizations of our country which tend to put so much importance on animal safety at all costs, if you know what I mean. And I just thank you that you have the perspective of letting nature have its course and that animals do survive in the wild, you know, on other, you know, other things, and I appreciate that. And also I wanted to add to your comment on the wild geese. I read in the paper that I believe it's Lake Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
It has a huge population, and they're doing what you just mentioned. They're going to be having a controlled kill and giving the meat to food pantries and processing it for animal food and such like that. So that was something I just read this weekend in the paper. So I'm glad to see that, you know, that there's an openness and a realism to your comments today, and I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Marty.
Well, thanks very much. We appreciate that. Part of the problem always with dealing with wildlife is that that people, human nature being what it is, we tend to be often concerned with the life and well-being of an individual animal, be it a baby rabbit or a goose or anything else, an individual animal, whereas the agencies, the professional biologists, the people who are charged with taking care of this very important public resource have to be concerned because of resources and philosophy with the well-being of the population of geese or rabbits or whatever. And if the population's doing well, then that's a success. These animals will perpetuate, will be here for future generations and so forth. But unfortunately, this preoccupation with individual animals and often attaching human attributes to them sometimes makes it very difficult to manage the populations in a way that's perhaps good for the population of animals as well as good for the humans who share the habitat with them. So
Paul from DePere is asking, what's up with the seemingly explosive population of both wood ticks and deer ticks and their movement south and east from northern Wisconsin? Could they be traveling and spreading with the wolf population?
I think it was just a really good spring for wood ticks, Paul. When we were up at the bird festival in Ashland a week ago this weekend, I took out a herpetology field trip, and we hadn't gotten 2 feet from the parking lot in the grass, and you could look down at anyone who had light-colored clothing on, and it was just a wave of ticks moving up people's clothing. I hadn't seen them as bad in a long time. I'm told that they're beginning to retrench a little bit and the population's dropping, but I think it's more likely a factor of the benevolent weather conditions this spring and the population's exploded. I doubt that movement on wolves or deer or bears or anything else is a huge factor, but certainly a lot of parasites do get around that way. And once they've established a beachhead and find things to their liking, then the population can grow wherever they're established. But admit it has been a bad year for ticks. I have lots of people asking, what is the purpose of a tick? And that's a question that I ponder myself at great length.
Before we go to the phones, one more question. You have some coverts workshops coming up at the Kemp Research Station in August. What are these workshops intended for?
Well, we talked about the coverts workshops last month on the program, and we were soliciting people who might be interested in attending. These are intensive 3.5-day programs targeted at private woodland owners, people who own forested land, preferably in Wisconsin, who are interested not only in improved wildlife management on their own property, but who are interested in carrying the message of good forest stewardship, including wildlife management and forest resources as a whole, out beyond their own land to their friends, their neighbors, their family members, their community, whatever. So we solicit 25 property owners for each of those two workshops, and all their expenses are paid. We take them to Kemp Station, and for 3.5 days, it's darn near a 24/7 array of field workshops and discussions and fireside chats and lectures and field trips and so forth. People love it. And the programs are August 12th to the 15th and August 26th to the 29th. Applications are still being taken until the 15th of June, although I think we probably have 80 or 90 applications for the 50 slots now, but we'll be going through those in a week or so. If someone's still interested in potentially attending, then they can contact my colleague who handles the registration and the applications in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And Jamie's email address is jlnack, J-L-N-A-C-K, at wisc.edu, jlnack at wisc.edu, and she can send you an application. But be advised that this, as I say, we've got a pretty good number of folks this year. We'll have more workshops next year. We can file your application away, but people seem to have a great time, and for us, it's a way to take advantage of the multiplier effect and essentially create a core of ambassadors who can go out there and promote good wildlife stewardship where we can't possibly reach every landowner.
Sounds like a good idea. Let's go to Bob in Claybanks next. Bob, thanks for waiting, and go ahead.
Thanks. Thanks for having the show today, Scott. I've got a couple questions, but first one more suggestion on the snapping turtle movement.
Mm-hmm.
I found something on the side of the road that I can wave in front of their face. They'll clamp onto it, and you can
drag them,
or pick them up. Sometimes.
Yeah.
One of my neighbors in southern Door County had a burrow of badgers, if that's the correct term, a den of badgers, I guess.
Okay.
There were four young, and they had a trail camera set up, so they got some pretty neat shots of them. I was curious as to how long those would. How long would they spend time around the den like that?
Well, it depends a little bit on the season. I mean, things got underway to a good start, but typically any of these animals that have a single litter a year, whether it's coyotes or fox or badgers or whatever, the young would be in the den for a period of some dependency while they're fed, then around the den, and then hanging around with the parent animals until latter part of the summer when they begin to disperse out on their own. So, I mean, they're still likely to be around the site at least for a while yet.
Hmm. And then I was looking at something in the woods a while ago that I had the shape of a bird, but I wasn't sure. And by the time I got a scope on it, it flew away, and it turned out to be a turkey hen. And she never came back for the nest to do anything with the eggs. There were about almost a dozen eggs in the nest, and you know, 5-6 days later, they were still sitting there, no sign of her.
Hmm. Well, you know, different birds are somewhat like people in terms of variation in their tenacity, and occasionally it's enough disturbance to a nesting hen, especially perhaps a young hen, that first nesting effort, and all of a sudden she's frightened, disturbed, or whatever, and takes off and either never comes back on her own, or in the process of being flushed off the nest, meets with some ill fate while she's off the nest and then can't return. But one way or the other, nest abandonment is not uncommon, and it all factors into ultimately the production of poults or young turkeys in a given year.
Have you ever harvested turkey eggs?
No. You mean for consumption of the eggs?
Yes.
No.
I'm just curious how long they might be good if they were sitting in a nest.
I'd be pretty nervous under warm conditions. and furthermore, I think there'd be a legal issue there in terms of actually harvesting the eggs.
Okay.
All right, Bob. Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And we're going to Dunn County next with Dave. Hello, Dave.
Hello. I have two questions. One is I'm concerned about the significant fish kill that's going on many lakes in Wisconsin. This was noticed by ice fishermen dropping their cameras down the hole and seeing the bottom with many dead fish bodies in the spring. A lot of fish are belly up. And my second observation was the past 20 years, it seems like smallmouth bass have just exploded in size and numbers. And it seems to me like the more smallmouth you get, the less walleye you get, and they're getting crowded out. So those are my two observations.
All right.
Well, I can't say much about the fish kill situation, Dave. That's something better taken to your local fish manager or perhaps questions about a specific lake. But relative to concern over burgeoning bass populations or VHS, the fish disease, or other things, and low water affecting fisheries, the notion of widespread fish kill is not something I've seen discussed in the outdoor literature or among the fish managers that I talk to. So I can't say much about that. But the smallmouth bass observation certainly seems to be true on the where I spend a fair bit of my time on the Minocqua chain. Holy mackerel, there are smallmouth bass all over the place. I mean, to the point that you can hardly drop a line and catch anything else. And whether it's cause and effect or not, the walleye population has certainly dropped off, at least in Lake Tomahawk and probably other lakes in the North Woods, although a lot of the concern right now seems to be finger-pointing more at the largemouth bass. And there are a number of experiments going on in some northwestern lakes to determine just what's going on there in terms of the relationship between largemouth bass and walleyes. Don't get me wrong, smallmouth are a great fish. They're fun to catch, and I just wish they were a little better table fare. And there's also a fair bit of concern now, given their numbers, should the 14-inch size limit on those bass be perpetuated, or should people maybe be catching more of the smaller bass and eating them the way they would panfish? I don't know. That's all going to be worked out over the next few years between fisheries studies and the Conservation Congress and a variety of other things. But you're absolutely right. There are some lakes that seem to have an awful lot of smallmouth bass.
Dave, thanks very much. We appreciate that comment and what you've been able to see. Amy's next in Menasha. Amy, what's on your mind today?
The reason I'm calling is this past weekend we were having a campfire in our backyard right here in town, and several of us who were at the campfire, we looked and we saw what we're assuming, we're pretty sure, was a bobcat in our woods. He was only about 10 feet away from us, just sort of pausing and having a look at us just as we were looking at him, and then when we turned around to see if everybody else was looking, he kind of just strolled away. But then since probably about the past week, we've been hearing these kind of crazy fights going on in the backyard also. And a friend who was over thought it was an owl maybe kind of killing a rabbit or something. But now then in the meantime, we've seen this bobcat, and now we're wondering, we heard it again last night, and we're just wondering if that would be likely that the bobcat would hang around or what.
Well, Amy, if you're fairly sure, or there are other people there are fairly sure that that's what you saw, then fine, you know, I can go with that. You saw a bobcat. Whether it's still around, I mean, that's not a part of the state where you'd expect bobcats to be very common, but stranger things happen, and we learned a long time ago on this and other programs to never say never. So let's accept the fact that you saw the bobcat. The fact that there are strange noises around does not necessarily equate to the bobcat's presence or not. There are so many things that make really weird noises at night that the bobcat is probably one of the less likely explanations. Young owls that your friend mentioned, young barred owls can make the most incredible screeching and god-awful screaming and hollering when they're hungry that you can imagine. It sounds like somebody's being dismembered in the neighbor's yard. Raccoons squabbling at night, all sorts of bizarre squeals and whines and screeches and howls and so forth. And night before last, the neighborhood pack of coyotes moved through my front yard and started yipping and howling and squawking at each other not very far from the house, about 2 o'clock in the morning, and that kind of set our two Labradors off to join in the chorus, and it was quite a commotion for a little while in the house. So there are lots of possibilities out there that offer an explanation besides the fact that an unusual animal like a bobcat might still be in the area.
Sure.
All right, Amy, thank you very much. We had an email from Leaf in Cross Plains, who said a friend of his said he saw a mink swimming in Black Earth Creek. Was he pulling my leg, or is this possible?
Quite possible. There are mink all over the place, even here on the Lake Mendota shoreline on campus. So, and they do swim, and I'd expect there to be a fair number of mink in Black Earth Creek. So no one is pulling anybody's leg.
All right. Edmund and Eau Claire, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a question as far as I heard that they were going to reintroduce moose in Wisconsin. I was wondering if this happened and if where they did it.
No, it did not happen, although moose have been trickling into Wisconsin from restoration in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan for some number of years now. Moose sightings are not unheard of. I haven't heard of any recently, but maybe that's because people have been preoccupied with cougars, wolves, and bears. But I think the party line is there could be as many as a dozen or so individual moose, primarily in northeastern Wisconsin, with their origin from the UP. And I think it was back in 2002 that we had the first recorded birth of a moose calf in northeastern Wisconsin in many, many, many years. So there are a few moose around, but they've not been restored as part of an effort to restore them to Wisconsin, but they've been trickling in on their own.
Is there any numbers?
Any what?
A number of moose in Wisconsin.
Well, as I said, I think no one knows for sure, but a few years ago I heard some estimates made that there could be 10 or dozen or 15 or more scattered around in any given year, but not large numbers by any means.
Edmund, thank you so much for your call. Let's try Bill in Cornell, see what's on his mind. Hello, Bill.
Hi. I got a question about squirrels. I had some squirrels raiding my bird feeders, and I started trapping them. I've trapped up to 36. Can they return back to the spot? I usually take them across the road 2 miles away across the river.
Well, crossing a busy road or a river is always a good idea in terms of minimizing return, but I think you might want to add a couple more miles on.
Okay.
Or alternatively, before you move them, grab the tail through the trap and clip a little bit of fur off or put a little paint on or something on the tail just so you can see if they are coming back. But I wouldn't be too concerned over 30. The current Madison record that I know of from one individual had sustained annual captures of an average over 10 years of 155 a year from his backyard.
I know
those weren't coming back.
Oh.
Okay. Trapping and removing squirrels is kind of a lifetime job security situation.
I'll reference that guy called about the moose. Last summer, one of my friends spotted a moose just north of Ladysmith and another one east of Ladysmith about 10, 15 miles.
Well, there you go. They're out there.
Okay.
And that's where you expect to see them.
Yep.
Is right out there. Let's talk a little bit more. You've got the Coverts Workshop coming up, and if people want more information, they should contact J.L. Knack. Is it N as in Nora, A-C-K?
Yes.
At wisc.edu. And next time that you're in, we'll have a CD from, we'll have some barred owl sounds so that
excellent.
We get a chance to hear what that can be. And in terms of is next in the wild outdoors after all of the young are hatched and dropped, why then it's just a chance to see them.
It's kind of an opportunity. We'll get into the summer doldrums when most of these animals are now preoccupied with growing up, putting on some fat reserves, and getting ready for another Wisconsin winter.
All right. So we'll look forward to your next appearance, which will be the first Wednesday in July. Professor Scott Craven is at the UW-Madison and Extension, Professor of Wildlife Ecology, and it's the wonderful world of Wisconsin's wildlife. Coming up tomorrow at 11, Rick Cini of FairCompare.com will look for airfare bargains for you, no matter if you're traveling domestically or internationally. You can check his website at FareCompare.com. And tomorrow at 11:45, Philippe Cocard of the Waldersheim Winery in Prairie du Sac and Paul Santoriella of Door Peninsula Winery will talk about growing grapes and making wine. That's coming up tomorrow. And, of course, if you'd like a CD of the program, it's always available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. I'm Jim Packard. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network.